This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Australian filmmaker James DiMartino. We're going to talk about the premiere of his film, The Faceless Man. James, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm also joined here with Cartrell Payne.
Yeah.
So, James, this is your very first feature film. Can you tell us about your background as a filmmaker and previous projects that you've worked on?
Yeah, okay, so basically I started making shorts in 2016. I made a total of six shorts, range of different genres. So I did comedy, I did mystery, I did a bit of thriller, and then I ended up making a period piece western that was in 2018, just before I started work on the feature, and it was quite a solid piece of work. So once we made a short that we were happy with, we decided to venture off into make a feature film at the start of 2018.
What are some of your cinema photographic influences? Is it primarily the horror genre?
So inspirations, did you say?
Yeah, cinema photographic influences and directors who inspire you.
Yeah, cool. Well, I've said in a lot of interviews so far that, you know, Tarantino's work is a big inspiration. Sam Raimi, Jennifer Kent, some of Jennifer Kent's work. And I kind of, you know, taken a lot from the Ozploitation era as well. A little bit of Brian Trenchard Smith. But those are the main... Mad Max was an inspiration to some extent as well, so George Miller. They were the benchmarks that I was working off. I was looking at their styles and taking a bit from here and there and trying to come up with my own at that time. So in terms of the cinematic look, I was quite specific on the movie having quite a lot of tracking shots, or holding the camera in specific styles. So I guess in terms of the film's opening shot being one long take, one of the inspirations for that was the True Detective episode season 4, and also crossing that over with the film Glengarry Glen Ross, the biggest insult scene in that. So that was my... that was the reasoning behind doing a long take, was I wanted to build up the drama and really escalate it with one big, argument in that opening shot.
How would you describe your personal directing style? Like, what traits would you say that you're known for, or that you would want to be known for?
Oh, right, yeah, cool. Well, I'm pretty, you know, I have a very... I'm quite open to what people want to bring, but at the same time, I have a very specific path and character arcs and why characters have to do certain things. When working with someone like Andy McPhee, for instance, they'll raise a lot of options or a lot of, they'll raise a lot of ideas, and most of them are going to be good, and they click with the character, and they really do add a lot to it. And, you know, because he's been doing it for so long, he does bring a lot of really good stuff to the table. In some situations, people do tend to talk a lot more. They raise opinions and ideas that are not related to the character. So for me, it's about that character has to have a certain arc from start to finish. And if characters, like, for instance, if they want to laugh at a specific time where they're not meant to, it's making sure that those character arcs are specific from the start to the end. Also, with the camera and the shots, I'm pretty big on planning the shots in advance. And then once we get there, we can have... Look, honestly, when you're working on low budgets, like what I was working on, it's always a real big challenge to, you know, have the shots prepared and you go to location and we only get so much time for blocking, or, you know, the location might be different than what we had in our head, so things do change. We don't have the luxury of having the extra money to, you know, really get that down to a T. So that was something that I was really specific about, with the long takes in the movie. There were quite a few of them. I think there was a total of 18 in the original cut, but then we had to cut some of those out. So there was a total of 16 or 17 long extended takes. So that when I mean long, I mean ones that go to a minute. The longest one we have is 9 minutes, but that they were spread out throughout the film to give it a bit of a unique style.
Sure. Like, were you ever influenced by American cinema? Because I'm thinking of becoming a filmmaker myself, and I was inspired by people as diverse as Alejandro Jodorowsky and John Singleton.
So what was the question? So about making films in America?
Oh, I said, what American filmmaker inspired you?
Oh, what American filmmaking inspired me. So as I said before, like, I guess Tarantino's work was probably the biggest inspiration, and there were quite a few throwbacks to his film in Faceless Man, from even the way a bit how the film was structured with, and Rob, you might have picked it up with the scene at the start, you know, like a it's a scene between two people, and then we go off to other characters later, a bit like Reservoir
Dogs. Oh, are you talking about the opening scene at the hospital?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then later on, we have a diner scene, and the shot setup is very similar to Reservoir Dogs in the diner. We don't play it too much. We are only there for like less than three minutes or so. But later on in the movie, we have this character that's a bit crazy, that does a bit of a dance as he tortures someone, and that was inspired again from Reservoir Dogs. So there was a lot of inspiration from that. There's another indie director called Jim Cummings. He did a movie called Thunder Road, that did very well, made Sundance, and the movie, there's a short, and then he made, the short is all one take. That's all it is. And I was kind of really inspired from that long take he did in just that short. And that was also kind of why I wanted that opening long shot in my film at the very start. And the feature film he made is very good as well. But it's not all one take, obviously, because, you know, budget and stuff. But that was two. Sam Raimi's work, Evil Dead, was kind of like a real cornerstone I worked on, and like that wrote the whole story. And then from there, I also had a bit of Get Out inspiration. So Get Out was also a bit of a, like, just how different that film was, you know, like I do wonder, like, if I did have a big budget and stars attached, how much different, you know, people, how much more people would have watched the film, or, like, you know, and seen the layers that I'd put into it, you know. The struggles for us is, and when you're working on budgets like I have, is really getting it out there and trying to get the most amount of people to watch it.
Are there any particular scenes that you would have liked to put in, but you weren't able to because of limitations on the budget?
I'm going to be pretty honest. Like, I mean, I was kind of lucky. I kind of got a lot of the shots and everything that I wanted to be in the movie. I kind of really knew going into this my limitation. I kind of knew what we could do and what we couldn't. The one thing that budget would have really helped was, you know, spending more money on makeup effects to get, you know, to get even better, or, you know, to get some even better makeup stuff. But I've had really good feedback from the makeup, so that might be just something that, like, you know, I would have liked more money so that I could have, you know, given them more stuff to play with, you know, or we could have, you know. But I guess the more money aspect kind of just really, you know, getting more stars attached to the film would have been helpful in, you know, getting more people to want to watch it. And also, you know, having more money would have increased, you know, then I could have got, you know, everything could have been, you know, up anted up, you know, in terms of locations and, you know, the quality of the film and everything, you know. So that's probably the... But I'm happy with the finished project. I mean, we're talking pretty deep here, that if we were to, you know, if I was to have more money, what I would aim to do, you know, like, just make it, you know, so look at the standard of, like, other horror films that come out. Yeah.
There's this theme of the city slickers who, they rent a home out in the country, and there's some tension with the locals, and then there's the monster who shows up and eliminates the characters one by one. That aspect of it is kind of a... I'm not saying your film is cliche, but that theme is sort of a cliche in horror. But then it goes in a direction where it's a very unconventional film. So were you kind of playing with that contrast of the conventional horror narrative with the unconventional?
Yeah, well, I mean, good question. I always wanted... I started off making a very unconventional horror film. I feel like it's... The whole movie is very unconventional as a horror because of all the comedy that's put in it. And I was always aiming for a very Evil Dead style movie. But the problem is that a lot of these horror movies, you know, like you said, pretty cliche. You have the monster, and then one by one, the monster kills off everyone one by one. How do you make something different? How do you make something that people haven't seen before? And that was the main gist behind The Faceless Man. Look, when you're dealing with low budget film, there's a real, it's brutally hard to get these films, people to go see them. And it's because of the quality that, you know, these films aren't made on a good quality or whatever. Having said that, I do feel that Faceless Man has that quality. So, but it was very hard to get the film like that. But, you know, it's quite a challenging thing to do. So I always wanted to make something different. This film had to be, you know, if I was going to make something like this, I didn't want to just make another horror film for the sake of it. I wanted to add to the pool of existing horror films and make a monster that was very different, you know, like, and play on the fact of what is real and what is not. That was the biggest thing. And really make a, you know, kind of blend genres of crime elements in there. Because I did love crime. And I really do want to make a crime movie one day. But, and also adding in the lighthearted, funny element to really break away some of the really horror parts of the film. Just so people can relax a bit before chucking them back in and making it really scary again. And I think another thing was sound was really crucial for me in the development of the film, and also adding to the mysterious and layered nature of the movie was the score was evolving with the film, and the mix and design was evolving with the monster. The more you see of it, the more scarier and out there the music for the monster gets as it goes on. So hopefully that answers, like, your question.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So the monster is not so much... It's not implied that it's a physical entity, but it could represent a symbolism or a manifestation of personal fears.
Well, I mean, see, that's an interesting point. So, personal fears, but for me it was always cancer. And some people do get that. They get the you know, that's the cancer coming back. Because, again, I didn't want to spend... food all the answers to people, because I felt that, like yourself and other people, they'll draw from it in ways and make an interesting story themselves. The reason why I say it's cancer is because she's coughing up blood throughout certain scenes of the movie. There's like two scenes that she she vomits, she coughs up blood. And that's supposed to be that the cancer's coming back. And that was the relationship with the cancer coming back. And she associated the cancer with her father and stuff. So that's the kind of thing we're going. Whether it was real or not, I kind of want to leave that up to people, considering that there were quite a few endings in the movie and, you know, that, you know, say otherwise. So, you know, I want people to be able to watch it and just take, and take with it. And also, the movie does generally take the piss out of a lot of horror films. It's kind of like, you know, I want people to think it's going one way and then quickly subvert expectations, in that direction. So, yeah.
So you draw it upon a personal experience. So you had cancer at an early age, and that's the inspiration from personal trauma. And the girl in the beginning and her story from the film?
Yeah, I did. You know, the different, the, there was a, I mean, what I like to do is generally get a story or an idea that actually did happen and then warp it or, you know, times it by 100 or really make it. You know, I was lucky that, you know, I had a good family that, you know, really did support me when it happened, but I was always very curious of people that didn't have that, and that's where I kind of like trapped it into a situation, like, and you know, I did a female protagonist in the movie because one, I wanted the challenge to write a female, two, I wanted a lot of the horror films from the 80s and stuff, which this movie was a big throwback to, had female protagonists, so we kind of, I mean, it was a decision that I came to where, you know what, It'll be good to have a female lead for this particular film, just with the dynamic between the father and the daughter as well, that I was aiming for. So another thing was to try and get that fear and resentment, and people do pick it up when they watch it about what the like how when you experience something like that, that fear, those sound designs and stuff that you see when the monster comes is kind of what it's like when you're, you know, having cancer. You always got this, it's like you got this lingering death around you all the time, and that was the kind of fear and emotion that I wanted people to have when they watched it more. And you know, the monster, and it's interesting because the monster's scary, but it's where we're putting him and everything that just adds to that. So yeah, so there was a lot of things that I drawed on from, you know, personal experience and just kind of warped it and, you know, did my, did and made it entertaining.
Do you think Australian cinema is underrated? Because it feels like it is to me.
That it's kind of. So you guys, I'm gonna assume you don't watch much Australian movies, or.
Well, I'm only really seeing like the big name movies, like Mad Max, and like this other movie I remember seeing a long time ago. I forgot what the name of it was, but.
Yeah. Okay, before I answer this question, for you guys, like, what do you think is the biggest problem with Australian cinema and film?
Well, I just think that, you know, I mean, there's, like, either some stereotypes that all you guys do is ride dingoes, or they don't really care about it, at least from an American media viewpoint.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was interesting. Like, I mean, last night, the Actor Awards were on, and, you know, The movies that are all selected and stuff there just seem like closed circuit films that have quite a lot of money pumped into it. I mean, when you look at them, all these movies had about, you know, eight million or more. I don't think there was one. The most of the films were all quite expensive, especially the ones that had gone all the way were, you know, backed by people. And the winner last night was The Nightingale. Which is actually quite a good film. I don't know if you guys saw The Babadook.
No, I didn't see it, but I heard it was good.
Yeah, very, I mean, well acted film. I mean,
yeah, I think I might have heard of that before. Is it based on a children's book?
The Babadook. Yes, actually, I did see that film a couple years ago when it came out.
What do you think?
I'm trying to, like, remember the.
Oh, she's constantly arguing with her son. And then the monsters in the book.
Oh, the one from the book. Yeah, I like that. I like that. With the idea where the monster's in the book and the surreal quality, I mean, and it was also relatively unique.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, in itself, that was $2 million for, you know, that was a lot of money on really just three characters in one house. So when you got that kind of money, it's and you have a pretty good script, and you have a few good TV actors and stuff that are in there, like that have, you know, and everyone on the crew is professional, it creates a, you get a film that's very well done at the end if you're there to really make a good fucking movie. You know, we had nowhere near that kind of money, and we were shooting in vastly, we were really ambitious with all the landscapes we were going to. We had many different locations, you know. We were trying to do a lot of really, we were doing things that people were calling us crazy for doing. And we were juggling a fuckload of characters, that no one else was even attempting, and I haven't seen many other films attempt. American films that have attempted, like Knives Out, that's a lot of characters in that movie, and it fucking works brilliantly. You know, but I haven't really seen many other Australian films really try to, you know, juggle a lot or try and break the mold. And there have been some films that have come out recently where I watch it and I'm like, wow, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money and I'm pretty bored. So, you know, yeah, there definitely does need to be some change. And I hope that, you know, I want to keep making, you know, films. So hopefully the next one I do will be even better and the one after that will be even better. Yeah.
Did the storyline in Faceless Man, did it change over the various drafts?
Yeah, it was really hard. As I said, the film had a lot going on, a lot of characters. So we had to really tone, some characters had to be cut down. Some had to be, you know, like the character of Nina was quite dominant in one of the scripts. She still was until the final cut, but you realize that certain things work better and certain things don't, and we wanted to make, you know, Emily more of the centerpiece of the story while weaving the other characters around her, which was quite challenging, especially when you've got a criminal boss who is who takes a while to get to the main point of the story. So you kind of have to dedicate a significant amount of time with each character to make sure that those emotional beats are hitting. And yeah, so the movie changed over many drafts, and there was one draft that actually explained a lot. Like, I'm talking, explained the origin of the Faceless Man, explained everything. And there comes a moment where I was heavily unsatisfied with the script because I just thought that, and I don't know if you guys have seen Hereditary, but in Hereditary, they kind of explain everything and it just comes out really shit. Like, I just didn't like it at all. And I kind of realized that I'm going to fuck the whole story up if I explain things. So I decided to leave a lot of it open and up to people's interpretation because there are a lot of filmmakers that have done that. David Lynch, for instance, never really gives much away. And, you know, his films are fucking amazing. And there are quite a lot of other films that I've seen, even recently, like In the Mouth of Madness with Sad Neill. There are other films I can't think of at the moment, but that do leave the film plot up. Well, Inception's a great case study or even on this, because a lot of people would watch Inception and not understand anything. They would like what they saw, but they still didn't get the plot, you know. So that's kind of what I was trying to do with Faceless Man, was really leave a lot of these, they're not plot holes, they're leaving up, it's made, the audience is able to come to their own decision, because there's enough story there to point things together. I just haven't spoon-fed everything to them. And that was really big for me when I made the movie.
Where did you get the idea for the vigilantes who enforce the town's moral codes?
Are you talking about the town folk or the,
yeah,
or the criminal?
The...
Oh, right.
The town folks.
Hi. Yeah, yeah, cool.
Bury the Sea and...
Eddie and Dougie.
Dougie. King Dougie.
Yeah, cool. So those characters were... I mean, it's kind of funny. You have a film called The Faceless Man, yet those characters were the ones that made me want to make the movie, you know? Which is kind of funny, especially, like, Barry and Eddie, though. Like, and Dougie as well. Like, Barry and Eddie were kind of like... They were kind of cast with those actors in mind, so they were always going to be those ones. And we had to get an Australian icon to play King Dougie, or it wouldn't have worked. And so we're lucky to get Roger Ward to play that one. That was very lucky. But Andy McPhee was always, I always wrote that character for him, and Barry the Sea was always written for Dan Reeder because he was a big intimidating guy. It's kind of funny because, like, you know, when we were, when I was coming up with ideas for the film and everything, like, you know, Eddie was kind of, I always thought that Eddie would be a showstopper stealer, scene stealer. And people just never really got the joke. And, you know, we kind of went around the round table read a lot. And because Andy was never there, he was always, you know, he wouldn't come to all the round tables. He only came to, like, one. And on that one, we actually didn't even focus too much on his lines and jokes and stuff. So it was always someone else filling in, and it was never that funny when we had a little guy saying it, or a smaller guy saying it. But I always knew it would be funny when Andy came on set and started doing it, and, you know, just his looks and, you know, his looks and mannerisms and stuff. So that added a lot to it. It was always really, like, I had to make sure that these characters were crazy, and also at the same time, kind of, you hate them, but you like them, and I feel like those three characters all have that relatability, is that, you know, with Barry, it's funny, and it's like, this guy's gonna kill someone, but people just like him because, like, he's that enforcer-type character. He's got comedic moments, but he's also pretty ruthless as well. And everyone in the town knows Barry, so it all links up. Then you got Eddie, who people really find funny, but at the same time, he's menacing as well, which kind of, like, you know, people really do like that oddball behavior. And with Dougie, I've had people sympathize with him because he's an older character, and he's, you know, philosophies and stuff is very different, and he's got a very fixed sense of justice as well. So there was three crucial elements that those characters needed to fit to the story. Then you had Victor on top of that, and Victor had to bring his own, you know, enforcer type quality to this town as well. So there was quite a lot of as you can, you know, there's four main bad guys there. Then you include Biff as well, the barkeep, who, you know, was a completely crazy character himself. And like I said, it was really important to make these characters all crazy. They all had to be almost to the point of ridiculousness where it turns comedic, for them to pull off the part. That was the whole intention.
What's the location of where you filmed this?
Yeah, so we shot it in Melbourne, mostly around Dramana, around the beach area, which is where we actually set the town. And it was all, and then we shot it around, like, around the Melbourne, surrounding Melbourne area.
And can you tell us about the special effects?
Yeah, sure. Creation of the monster was, that was a bit tricky. I had to get someone to illustrate the monster first, so it was all drawn. Austin Mengler I found at one of the expos that I went to, and I loved his designs. He had a very, you know, unique style, and I'm like, well, do you do commissions for, like, a movie and stuff? And he gave me his card, and then we worked out a price, and then he did all this art for the Faceless Man. There was so much art. And it looked awesome when he came up with his design. We worked through it together first, you know. I told him about what I wanted, how I had to be cancer, how, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it, we also took on from sleep paralysis as well, and, you know, many different ideas. We decided that the monster should be more man than monster. So that was the decision for budget and also for what we wanted to accomplish. Then I had to get a makeup artist to do one of it, Emma Rose, and she had help from Dale Blanford, who was actually worked on Wolf Creek and the Babadook as well, so he had a bit of experience, and those two worked countless hours to get the molds done on time, because Austin had sketched everything, but he had sketched, you know, all the three sides of the head, how it should look, and Emma kind of made that. And then we also had Chanel Kumo, who did all the, who did a lot of the practical effects. So, you know, the eye, the end of the movie, all the blood and stuff was all done by her. So there was a combination of those two talented artists, and also Austin's design. And then we had to make sure that it worked good on screen. So, yep, that's about it.
And this is from Chapter 5 Studios. So this is your independent production production studio. Do you have other projects with Chapter 5?
Yeah. So at the moment, I'm working on my next film. I've actually got the draft. I've actually got the draft 2 now. So I'm working that. I've still got a bit of a ways to go, but I'm, you know, headhunting people and we're working at the budget that we need to shoot this. It's more of a dark comedy coming-of-age story, so it'll be more of a drama-focused. It's very different than The Faceless Man. It's not genre, even though the start of the movie kind of has a bit of action and stuff in it, but I'm not going to really give anything away because it's much too early, but that's the main pulp project I'm working on. I'm also working on a crime script as well that's very Pulp Fiction, you know, Snatch-style film. That I really want to get off the ground and make. So I've got those two projects, and I've got a variety of scripts that are written: sci-fi, dystopian revenge, and dystopian case studies that I want to, you know, I've got, but they require quite a bit of budget to do. So there's no point spending at this stage in my career to spend days doing that when, you know, I can make stuff for a lot cheaper. And really scripts that I really want to do as well. So, and there's a lot of stuff that, you know, I realized after I made my film that there are so much things I need to do to, you know, bring that bar higher in the next one and get even better.
So The Faceless Man, how many film festivals did it premiere at?
So it premiered at Monster Festival, Monster Fest in Melbourne.
Okay.
Yeah. So it premiered at Monster Festival, sold out screen, and we also, then after that we had our own premiere. So our own premiere was at Classic Cinemas, and that was again a near sold out experience. And then we've had a few screenings since then, so we've had a few down at Germana Drive-Ins. We also had another one at the Classic Cinemas, and now, what happened with Muff? Muff was meant to be our 7th screening, but Muff got cancelled this year. So it got pushed back to next year. So that's still happening, but next year. In April, I think. So what we're doing now is we're doing another screening on January the 12th at the Thornbury Picture House as a double feature with another indie film called No Such Thing as Monster.
Can I ask the question?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so your dark coming-of-age comedy movie, is it going to be anything like Heathers or Fast Times at Ridgemont High or The Last American Virgin, which were kind of like dark teen movies?
It's more in line with, like, I'm trying to think of a good example here of like a coming of age story that was
Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. That's a good one.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a really just going to blank, but it's more of the line of, like, you know, have you seen Living in Oblivion?
No.
Right, okay, well, it's kind of like that, but, you know, kind of like everything, you know, it's more of a character case study on in the arts and, like, everything it means to make a film, you know? So that's the kind of gist behind it. I'm trying to think of I'm just drawing a blank on the coming-of-age story. There was a good example I had recently, but, yeah, I don't have it at the moment. But yeah, I mean, it spirals one specific project, but it has a few flashbacks into how, you know, what it means to do.
For the people in the audience interested in viewing The Faceless Man, when is it going to be available to watch?
Yeah, so at the moment we're still doing a bit of theatrical releases, so, and also festivals. So that'll probably take about a year. So The Faceless Man probably won't become available for DVD or VOD for some time. But if you're in Australia, in Melbourne, then we will be doing screenings every now and then. As I said, the next one is on the 12th of January. The reason why we're doing this is generally because we're in the process of selling the film overseas, and we also want to have a pretty good festival run before we put it on DVD and VOD. We've just done things the opposite. We've just decided to release our film in Australia a bit earlier because there were a lot of people here that wanted to see it before we end up getting our sales deals and everything happening. So.
James DiMartino, it has been an excellent show. I'd recommend checking out The Faceless Man, and thanks for being on.
Yep, thank you, guys.
You're welcome.